Iran wasn't a great power like Germany. It wasn't a great power like the Soviet Union. We're making Iran a major power as we go forward. But this was the biggest one, much more difficult than Vietnam, much more difficult than Iraq, much more difficult than Afghanistan. And so the consequences of taking on that much more dangerous, difficult foe are going to be with us really significantly longer.
Robert Pape has been analyzing, tracking, running simulations on all of this. Literally, the final lesson that this guy has taught at college, at school for a very long time, for a period of years, has been, oh, what would a simulated, you know, attack on Iran look like?
We are in a wicked escalation trap. We're not just seeing escalation. We're seeing it grow horizontally, and we're seeing Iran now initiating attacks, not just on the receiving end. The United States started this war and is now in a strategically worse position and is trying to simply get back to even. This war has upended the balance of power in the region that existed before the war. Before the war, America was the ascendant power, Israel the rising power, and Iran the declining power. Now all of those lines are reversed. And Iran thinks it won the war and it should be in control of Hormuz and have large influence in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East it did not have before. The United States is trying to reverse its defeat and is not accepting the new status quo.
The history of us covering this Iran war and being against it, this whole conflict, is not some crackpot theory that we have about how this could potentially be bad. This is what all the experts have said, again, since before day one. You can go to college professors like Pape. You can go to analysts like Larry Johnson.
We don't have good intelligence, and we certainly don't have ground-penetrating radar that tells us how many missiles they've got stacked up in these tunnels and buried in these mountains. But I guarantee you that in addition to storing such missiles, they're also doing production of such missiles in these secure locations. So we don't have even a clue exactly how many they have.
You can go to literally everybody who commentates and talks about this in the online geopolitical space. This is not rocket science. Look at this. Trump's pattern of strategic defeat is only leading to more escalation, a world economic crisis, and more gains for Iran. This is the thing. The longer it lasts, the more concessions they're able to extract out of us. And the situation that Trump is in, it's very tough. He doesn't have the ability to extract concessions from the Iranians, but at the same time, he doesn't have the ability to extricate himself from the conflict, because if he does, Israel remains under threat because they're violating what Iran wants them to do by not invading Lebanon and not killing the rest of the Palestinians. You have to understand, this is all an ethno-supremacist war.
It sounds like you're saying one Jewish life mm-hmm. is worth hundreds or thousands of Palestinian lives.
Not a million. One Jewish life, it's 10 million, okay?
That just sounds racist.
Yes, I know. But this is the truth. Because God chose us. Because of this, you are jealous.
And it's not our ethnicity. It's not white people. It's not black people. It's not Mexicans. That's not the problem. What's the quote from The Hobbit? There's no need for a war between dwarves, elves, and men. A legion of orcs marches upon the mountain. Like, this is a real problem. We're fighting and dying in a war, an ethno-supremacist religious war, for people thousands of miles away that we're not related to and could care less about, that have no relation to the foundation or history of our new republic / empire here the last 250 years of the United States. It's a ludicrous idea to think that you have to go fight and die or serve a state like this. And it's a ludicrous idea that any political candidate would come to you hat in hand and tell you you just have to be good and support them a little bit harder, and we're going to be able to get all this done. We're never going to be able to get any of it done.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bigley has launched an online pharmacy, 1776rx.health. It's one product we're launching with, my decision, and that is ivermectin with benzidol, both powerful really good anti-parasitics. It doesn't just get the big worms and all the crap that's out there. It's amoebas, it's microplasms. It is so important. These two together, I mean, ivermectin is a Nobel Prize winning for this, but minbenzidol is the big one. And folks, it isn't just parasites. Just search minbenzidol studies. Just put that into a search engine and you'll see congressional hearings. You'll see top scientists. You'll see all the studies on what else it does that they don't want you to know about. It's dramatic. So, and you won't know if you had any type of parasitical deal or whatever until you've done this. And a lot of people went there yesterday. A lot of people got it. Very smart move. 1776rx.health.
Alex Jones Show, because there is a war on for your mind.
Well, there's nothing spookier than geopolitics, and we have a geopolitical roundup overview, fourth hour on The Alex Jones Show for you today. I'm your host, Rex Jones, being joined by Brandon Weikert. Brandon Weikert is the senior national security editor at 1945.com. He manages the Weikert Brief on Substack. You're on basically all the big geopolitical commentary analysis channels. I see you on Mario Newfall basically every other day now, and you're hosting daily. So I just want to welcome you back to the show. So what's going on there with Mario?
Well, he's got some of the best guests in the world. I mean, you sent me a thing that he just did with Mirandi of Iran. So he's able to get not just the American point of view, he's able to get, you know, the other side as well. And I think that's integral.
Here's the thing. I like watching 80-year-old Air Force generals on Fox News. I think they know the reality of what's happening around the world. I don't want to listen to all the experts and the people with real credentials that aren't in government because they're too serious. I want to go watch Jack Keane.
Well, I will say that Mario seems to be hazing me a little bit now that I'm working with him, because he keeps giving me all the neocon generals in the afternoon. So I sit there and I have to sit there and listen to how great Israel is all the time.
You do a good job. It's a balanced show. Here's the thing. Here's what I appreciate about Mario's channel in general. You want to see what's called, my dad calls it, wide spectrum analysis. You want to see what everybody says. And here's the thing. If you hold anti-position against somebody's pro, it's only going to make you weaker if you don't hear their position. Because you're not going to know how to refute it or respond to it. And ultimately, you don't really have the right to, right? You got to put yourself in that environment. I've been trying to do more of that. Been trying to do more debates and other such things.
Yeah, and I think, the way you beat the information war is you first of all have to understand what the other side is thinking. And I will tell you, I used to think there's no way these guys believe this. I've spoken now to some pretty high-level people on Mario's show over the last 2 weeks who are committed neocons, committed Zionists. I was a former neocon myself in my youth, because that was what you were if you were a Republican working in government. That's just the way it was. So they really believe it, these guys do, and these gals. I mean, I talked to Victoria Coates recently of Heritage. She was formerly the Middle East policy director for the first term of the Trump administration. Nice lady. She really believes this stuff. So, you know, I think it's important that audiences listen and understand that these are the people currently or previously speaking to the highest levels of our politicians in both parties. And if you're wondering why things are falling apart, if you're wondering why, you know, there's really no policy difference in the foreign policy realm, at least between Biden and Trump, well, you begin to understand why. There is a deep state. It is a bipartisan fusion party, as Michael Walsh calls it. And you got to understand it if you're going to beat it. And so when I talk to these people, I do let them talk. I don't try to do the Fox News scream at them thing. I try to understand. And I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot in just 2 weeks about what I'm dealing with.
For sure. This is my thing with people like that. It's one thing to be on the civilian side and to have like a different opinion or whatever. But when you're established in government and you've watched multiple of these disastrous campaigns, specifically in the Middle East with the same exact cast of characters over and over and over again, how do you say, it is what it is. Time for a round 1 million. Do they have any like realm of, are they thinking about the consequences of this stuff at all? Or do they genuinely think that we can do it again?
Yeah, they genuinely think that. You listen to, I think Mark Thiessen this morning or in the last 24 hours put out a tweet making fun of TPUSA of all places. I guess Andrew Colvett issued a tweet where he was explaining how one of their college members was saying the cost of food for students is so high. And Mark Thiessen's response was literally, cry me a river. And it's like, they really think not only America is Superman and we can do it all, but any hardship, you know what? Just deal with it. It's temporary. Be a man and man up.
Right.
And it's like, that's not what an actual U.S. policymaker is supposed to think about. Remember George Washington, his farewell address. Remember Eisenhower's farewell address. It's very clear some of our greatest military leaders who became presidents, Washington and Eisenhower, would not have agreed with Mr. Mark Thiessen. They would have been disgusted by that view, because the idea is not suck it up, we got to just go kill these people. The idea is, what is in America's best interest? It's also a bit of a Hippocratic oath. You have that in medicine, first do no harm. Well, the same thing applies to foreign policymakers in Washington. First do no harm to the American people or to the national interest. If you're thinking about taking an action, always weigh it against, first of all, what are the knock-on effects, which they never do, and second of all, what happens to the prosperity at home? What happens to the average American? They never ask those questions.
Let's coin a new phrase right here, political malpractice. That's what it sounds like. Oh, we have the right to do it, the authority to do it, and then they do it over and over and over again like an insane person expecting different results, and it just results in more pain for the country. Where does that come from?
And then, it also comes from ideology. They are ideologically, and this is particularly bad on the right with the so-called neocons, although I think a better term for them would be democratic globalists, because that's really what they are. And in this case, democracy does not mean something good. It means that they've turned it into a fetish and they want to visit it upon everybody else. It's sort of like gay pride. You know, it's visited upon everybody now, that's what they do. But it's an ideological thing. It's also obviously connected to an Israeli thing. This is all coming from certain people that are pro-Israel. That's always the commonality there. That's why it cuts across both parties. And then also you have the money factor, right? I mean, there's a lot of money and a lot of prestige that comes from being a neoconservative, of being a democratic globalist. Robert Kagan, there's a reason he's such a large man. He lives very well. He's very well protected. And this is sort of the problem we have, is you may elect the most Tea Party, the most, MAGA, or on the other side, you may elect the most democratic socialists of America, but 9 times out of 10, the moment they get up to DC, they get a look around and they realize how it's really run, and they want to be in on the in crowd. And that's why you have these people that get up there as outsiders. Within 2 years, most of them are no longer outsiders. They're bought and paid for.
Right. And I guess we can kind of watch that metamorphosis in my view, specifically with Trump, right? Because Trump loses money in his first term, does not have knowledge of the political apparatus, or he doesn't have any knowledge of the components. You get people like John Bolton, people like Jeff Sessions, people like Bill Barr, and just establishment swamp creatures. And he gets out, persecuted, has the miraculous resurgence in 2024. And then he's a part of the club. He comes back and it's just like, well, I describe it as what I call the Reagan deal. You can remake the party in your image. It can be your branding, the way they have the Reagan Bush 84 t-shirts and everyone walks around in those. That can be you in 20 years, Trump. That will be the identity of the party forever. You'll be like Lincoln. You'll be like Reagan. It'll be Trump. You'll be on Mount Rushmore. And I bet that appealed to him. But it just doesn't seem like he cared about the other aspect of that, which in my view is selling out. You lose everything when you take that deal, because you don't get to be the Reagan figure. You get to be Netanyahu's figure. And that's how America will see you. It doesn't matter it doesn't even matter how many billions of dollars you have, how many political institutions you have, how many campaign offices you have. It doesn't matter for the GOP. Here's the thing. I just watched JRE. I was watching Andrew Wilson's episode with Rogan, the second one he just did. And I mentioned in it, and he's like, he was arguing with me, and I was telling him how the two-party system wouldn't work. It's creating its own destruction. When I advocate for independent candidates or someone running inside the Republican Party or whatever it looks like, I'm advocating for that because I see that as a lot more of a rational path for us to fix or take over the Republican Party versus what we have if we just accept them railing us, essentially, is they're doing it to themselves. It's not our fault that you're going to be hurt in these elections when you have a Coffin's coming home draped in American flags. Like, you're creating that campaign ad. We're not the ones doing it. And that's what really bothers me. What do you think?
Well, and interestingly enough, though, I actually just talked to Mario about this about 2 hours ago when I was in the guest role at that point on his show. And I said to him at the end there, I said, the one thing I'm surprised by is the Democrats haven't turned the Iran war into a real political victory for them. The way the Democrats did. I lived during the Iraq War. I remember how my Democrat friends on the other side were able to really convert, the failures of the Bush administration into real political, hey, it ultimately evangelized. Led to Obama.
Yeah, they evangelized.
Right. It ultimately led to Obama. No, wait, without Iraq war, I don't believe there would have been an Obama. I think that maybe at most you would have got, at best for them, they would have had Hillary, who would have just been a continuation. The Iraq war creates Barack Obama, creates the generational change that the Democrats needed in 2006 to 2008. So they are not doing that, though, with this war. And I was telling Mario, I said, I really think the reason they're not is because, let's face it, a lot of the elite who run the DNC, they are themselves Zionists. They are themselves fine with this war. They don't like the fact that the Iranians have continued on, and they may not want the Republicans and Trump to get credit, but they're also not going to do much to complicate
the ability
of Trump to wage the war.
That's the thing about my political theory is people just don't see, like, literally, it's like a Yellowstone, the caldera could explode at any time and be a massive super volcano. Like, I can feel the rumbling because I'm young and I watched this happen with Trump the first time. And this is my prediction. I'm 23. I could be totally wrong, but I watched him come down that escalator. I watched that first debate. Yep. I told my dad he would be president, and my dad laughed at me and called me effing crazy. All right. Who's laughing now? None of us. Spoiler alert. We're all kind of a little bit terrified here of what Robert Barnes calls frontal lobe dementia. But like, I sense that same energy because whoever you have up there, both on the Democrat side, Republican side, it's going to be a huge field. It's going to be a massive field. You're going to have at least like a dozen people running on both sides that'll be able to pull at least like 1-5%. You know, I remember the days of Kasich and candidates like that, days of candidates. Who else was running back then?
It was Kasich. It was Rand. It was Ted Cruz, Raphael. It was Marco.
Little Marco.
Egg McMuffin. But he wasn't a Republican. I think he ran independent.
Jeb Bush. Lest we forget, Jeb Bush, the man polling as a front runner at the beginning. And this is my whole point.
He had all the money.
Yes.
He had all the money.
All the cameras, all the action, everything. But the party itself had no energy because he had no energy, had nothing to run on. In fact, he had the vulnerability of the familial association with the Iraq war. And I think if you get Rubio up there, and I think if you get even Vance up there, and you have somebody like a Marjorie Taylor Greene, like a Joe Kent, like a Thomas Massie that says, hey, you know, we were actually hurt and persecuted because we tried to stick to the 2024 platform. When did you stick to the 2024 platform? Yeah. I think that really hurts them, that question.
Or a Tucker Carlson might be. You know, crazier things have happened.
What's your theory?
That would be wonderful.
Break this down, because there was a dinner. There was a table photo that was taken. Break this down.
I don't know what that was about. I was just saying, you know.
To speculate.
This wouldn't be the first time an outsider from the media was able to pummel their way in because of the failures of the establishment. And, you know, I like J.D. Vance, but, you know, and Vance, to be fair, Vance has been, in my opinion, mischaracterized. I do think he did what he could from the inside to stop the war, but he's the vice president.
I don't think, that's what I was about to say. As VP, I wouldn't have taken that job. Personally,
I tell you what I would have done the minute Trump threw me under the bus with Versailles, when he was like, well, if it goes wrong, I'm going to blame JD. And then, you know, when Trump went out of his way to humiliate and degrade the MOU, I think partly because it was seen as a Vance victory, because Trump has a weird thing about his subordinates getting more airtime. He gets very jealous. So if it were me, I would have issued my resignation. Then again, though, there is a chance something happens to Trump in the remainder of his term, and then Vance can be elevated into the presidency. So that might be why he's sticking around. But I would have resigned because you're not having the impact. But anyway, but the thing is, Vance is tainted on some level by this administration now, the failures of this administration. We might get lucky and get a deal on Friday. We might have a de-escalation. As I told Mario today, though, I am not convinced this is a permanent end of the war. You know, I think this would just be another pause, maybe several months worth, but another pause. I think Trump will keep trying to take a bite at the apple because I think he's insane. And so, right. I don't think this is the end of the war. But the point is, every time we go back through this iterative violence, it hurts the political fortunes of the president and certainly of his possible successors. And I think actually that's one of the reasons why I was told by somebody who's close to Marco Rubio, Rubio really doesn't want to run in 28. That's what I've been told.
Really?
Rubio doesn't want to really run in 28. Now that could be disinformation. But I was told privately, and I live in Florida and I have a lot of connections to Florida politicians in terms of their staffs and whatnot. But I was told by somebody who's very close to him that he's really not interested in 28. The only thing I can think of is because Rubio's smart enough to know he can read the writing on the wall. The Republicans are not going to win 28. So why run and taint himself, you know, with a loss when he can just hold out till 4 years thereafter when the Democrats are back in and they don't achieve whatever the hell they think they're going to achieve. So that is a possibility. But you know, the war has been so damaging. I think Vance has damaged goods now. And so it wouldn't surprise me if an outsider like a Tucker or even a Joe Kent, who, yeah, he was in the administration, but he wasn't at a cabinet level or a, you know, vice presidential level.
I like the resignation letter. I like the resignation letter personally. That's my benchmark standard to run. If you say your wife died in a war manufactured by Israel, like I don't think AIPAC can ever slide the back door.
Look, the guy brought the receipts too. It wasn't just a political statement he made, right? He spent the next 6 months, 7 months going on international television and bringing the receipts, proving that Mark Levin and the neocons were piped in to the White House constantly. I mean, I know Joe and I know his family and you know, he's an honest guy. You know, you may disagree with his politics, but the guy is very honest and he's not a liar. So he's not lying. That's why they hate him in the White House, because he's bringing the receipts and he's a threat because he is the most decorated, well-known war hero of the global war.
Well, that's the thing.
Era.
That's the thing. On the 2028 GOP potential field, I see a bunch of weak sisters. Right. I see a bunch of people that are establishment, that are in power, that are going to be running by nature of, it's like a, you know, the rotten, spoiled son of a king or something. So like Joffrey from Game of Thrones. Right. It's like I get appointed into this position that I don't even deserve versus somebody that's been out there in the wilderness, like a Tucker, like a Joe Kent, like a MTG, like a Thomas Massey. I think the people that make the pseudo analytical arguments about, oh, well, you just can't ever go up against the machine. We proved that wasn't true in 2016. I think that fake analytical argument is actually an emotional argument. And it's kind of like a disbelief thing. They don't want to believe that change is possible. But at one point, Trump wasn't a figure at all in the Republican Party. At one point, people weren't even thinking about that.
He was a threat to the GOP.
Right.
I mean, at one point, remember, he was also, you know, he wouldn't take the pledge in 2016 to support another candidate if he lost. I loved that.
Right.
I was like, this is awesome. Why would we getting into this and you're, I'll support, you know, he made it clear. To be fair, he wasn't a lifelong Republican. He was a Democrat for most of his adult life, a moderate Democrat, but he was a Democrat and he funded Democrats cause he needed to, and he funded Republicans when he had to, but he was a businessman at a very high level. So I always appreciated the honesty there. Something's changed with the guy. And it's no longer just impacting the domestic scene. It's now, as you're seeing, it's having really bad implications for the United States on the global strategic level. It's not just even losing the Iran war. It's now empowering China. It's now empowering the rise of this new alternative Eurasian order. That order was always in the offing. But in my opinion, because the president has been co-opted by these forces, he's now expedited the rise.
Let's get into that, because we got about like 3 minutes, 30 seconds left in this segment. And then in the next segment, I want to do a deep breakdown on what's happening geopolitically. But really, I think what you're hinting at is what my guest talked about on the show yesterday, Green Beret Matt Murphy, talking about the war between the BRICS and the Abraham Accords. And kind of a situation going on there. So kind of a little bit of a roundup in the time we have left.
Yeah. So the Abraham Accords is an interesting frame, because the Abraham Accords are dead. There is no Abraham Accord, no matter what the president says. He killed it with this war. You could make the argument that the Israeli response to 10/7 really killed it. I talked to an Israeli brigadier general about this on Sunday on Mario's show, and it was just fascinating to hear the alternative reality. But ultimately, even the Israelis are sort of skeptical that the Abraham Accords, as they were envisioned, are possible now. Of course, they don't make the connection that it was their actions that caused the destruction of the Abraham Accords. So I would push back on the framing of Abraham Accords versus the BRICS. Certainly BRICS, that's a fact.
Well, I see Abraham Accords as greater Israel, right? Because, I mean, they're going to have to take parts of these countries.
The Zionists.
So whatever, they'll give it a cute name, a pretty name, but really just that war between the West and the East.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely a thing. And Michael Yon talks a lot about this too, which is basically, in his view, it's no longer the U.S.-led system versus the Han Chinese. It's now Zionism in the West versus the Han Chinese in the East. I think that's a very fair thing to say. I think you're seeing that play out. I think that's where it's going to go. The problem for the Israelis is that the two potential partners they needed in that kind of grand strategic fight, the United States are the obvious partner, but the Russians possibly as well. The Israelis have been destroying and degrading both of those countries, right? I mean, the Ukraine war is basically in some weird way connected to the Israelis, and through that war, they're damaging and irritating the Russians and forcing the Russians into the Chinese camp. To be clear, the Russians did not want to be in the Chinese camp. This is not a natural partnership, but they have had to go there because they've been forced into this position, into a shotgun wedding, and they're making the best of it now with Xi. But you know, Israel could have used, especially because they have a lot of cultural ties and historical ties that the Jews of Israel do to Russia. They could have used that, exploited that to their advantage. They didn't. They've instead gotten behind this Ukraine fiasco, and they've degraded Russia and they've aggravated Russia. Meanwhile, the United States, the key partner of the U.S., everything that the Israelis have done in the Middle East, everything they've encouraged in Ukraine, this has broken the back of the U.S. defense industrial base that they're so keen on exploiting. And it's basically set the conditions where Israel doesn't have the kind of partners it needs anymore. They may on paper, but the U.S. can't do certain things. You just saw the head of UCOM on Sunday say he's now at a point where he has to decide, because there's such a lack of destroyers, U.S. destroyers, as well as the SM-3 air defense systems those destroyers are using, he has to decide between homeland defense of the U.S. and defense of Israel. That's not a position Israel should have wanted to be in. So even their grand plan is not going to work as they see fit. They're going to lose this thing.
Totally disturbing. We'll be right back. Geopolitical analysis with Rex Jones on the network with Brandon Weikert. Thank you so much for joining us. See you after this break.
A microscopic tag being planted in a person's body to track his every movement. There's actual discussion about that.
And often they're things you don't know what to do with. UBOs, they're called unidentified bright objects.
Can brain scans be used to determine whether a person is inclined toward criminality or violent behavior?
Who's got the brain that's going to be most susceptible to a particular kind of manipulation?
So the point is, they've been obsessed with this. It's going on. The COVID shots implanted the matrix graphene oxide to grow. It's now being scanned. It's now being read. They were putting chips in the troops 30 years ago. The revolution's already here, is what you're saying, Jesse Beltran.
These are just chips on a size that you can no longer see. They're nano size, once 2,000 times the width of a human hair. The graphene oxide, the silicon-based materials that have been in, we know for a fact that they were in the mRNA. We know that Dr. Ido Bachelet signed a contract with Pfizer in 2015 when he did that TEDMed talk with a trillion robots in a 1cc syringe, and how he teaches his students how to, once they're in a host, how to control them with RF emissions.
And you heard Colin saying 21 years ago that, oh yeah, when we're doing scans, we find all these chips, these bright objects, ha ha ha, wonder who put them there. But as you said, you've been doing this 20 years, and about 10 years ago, you began to go away, not seeing chips anymore, but just liquid emulsion nanotech. Here you are 6 months ago or more, scanning me. Let's go to Alex Jones getting scanned.
So if you put that camera in there, you see how it says probably silicone? That means it's an electronic component. And it's not unusual to find that in the posterior ear area.
So wait, I got a higher reading than him?
No, his was higher than yours.
Okay,
yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, but you did get a positive reading there. So you are getting the you know, base of the neck is what we typically see. Scapula area. What we're finding is after post-COVID, this is very typical. We're completely bombarded by this stuff.
From your own research, there are compounds naturally in nature that just do absolutely incredible things that will draw out these type of things. But you guys have come up with one with scientists that adds these special sea minerals in that then even drags it out even more. And so I have been taking this, the dreams I've had, my skin, my health, what it's done is absolutely insane. GetMasterpiece.com. Matt Hazen, tell us what this does, and people can get 10% off when they follow the URL, GetMasterpiece.com, or use promo code Alex when you're there on the site, because this is really special.
Zeolite is an incredible mineral that is known as what's called the master binder. And what that means is it's known to pick up every type of forever chemical, toxin, toxic heavy metal there is, including fluoride. So when you see charcoal or carbon or clays for binders, you don't see that they will pick up fluoride. Zeolite's different. Zeolite also gets the fluoride. That's a very big deal. It is great at removing these environmental toxins from our body. Masterpiece is the highest grade sea mineral plasma solution. It is basically isotonic, the same mineral composition as your blood plasma. So the sea minerals are being carried in by the nanometer, sub-nanometer size clinoptilolite zeolite. And once the toxin hits the zeolite, it releases and displaces the mineral. People don't feel bad. There's no normal detoxing reaction.
Everybody needs to go to GetMasterpiece.com. You get 10% off by using that URL automatically when you go. There's promo code Alex as well. GetMasterpiece.com.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
We now take you live to the Central Texas Command Center and the heart of the resistance. Rallying patriots worldwide. You're listening to The Alex Jones Show.
Welcome back to the broadcast, doing the geopolitical roundup with Brandon Weicker. We the Brandon on X, follow him there, geopolitical analyst, former staffer on the Hill, all-around political animal and great guy. Thank you for coming back with me here. I want to talk to you about Iran. I want to talk to you about Ukraine. Specifically, before we get into Ukraine, what is going on with this new 60-day MOU 2.0? What's going on in Iran?
Yeah. So it's interesting because it's been very murky. And, you know, this is another thing I've been chatting with Mario about, because he has some inside sources that really inside sources over there.
Sure.
And he told me about 3 or 4 days ago that I was being a little too negative, because he was hearing that the president was actually never planning to go through with the threatened strike last weekend, because the president is very worried about targeting energy infrastructure in Iran, knowing that the Iranians will retaliate not only against Saudi Aramco, and other energy production sites in the region that would obviously spike the price of oil. But the Iranians have the capacity to strike energy infrastructure here in the United States. So there was, it was a bluff. Mario says, I don't know about that, though. I think the president might have been very serious and then walked off back from that.
Do you think the other Gulf country leaders like MBS, the Emiratis, yeah, and others were like, hey, just we got to please don't throw us into the fire?
Yeah, so I have a, I should have sent you that too, at the Weichert brief, the second most recent article, I had an inside source in Saudi Arabia that claimed, and I couldn't confirm it, and I make it very clear, this is all unconfirmed, but basically, before the weekend where Trump was saying he was going to do military terror, which by the way is a war crime, on Iran, the MBS had a phone call with President Trump, in which supposedly he implied that if Saudi Arabia's energy production is taken offline in a retaliatory strike by Iran, they were going to sell off lots, if not all, of their treasuries. They have about $140 billion worth of treasuries. That's a big problem because obviously we're currently in a dicey financial situation. And also we're trying to bail the Japanese yen out. So if the Saudis and the Qataris, it's either UAE or Qatar has another $140 billion, I think. So if they did a timed dumping of U.S. treasuries as like an FU to us for burning them, the whole system implodes. So I think that also was a factor. Anyway, I think that the president didn't really have a role. The White House didn't really have a role in the current negotiations. And that's been confirmed now. Trump's talking like he's the big Billy Badass.
But how? They call him desperately every day begging for a deal. This is what we're told. Explain this, Brandon.
The reverse is more like it. Unfortunately, I wish the American leadership had all this leverage. No, the reverse is more like it. The president knows we're running low on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. As long as those sources are stopped up in the Strait of Hormuz and the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, we're effed in the long run. Shipping industry is collapsing right now. So the president's begging for a deal. And the Iranians are indirectly talking to us through the Omanis, the Pakistanis, the Saudis, even the Egyptians are involved. The Omani deal is basically, they've whittled it down to, instead of two separate routes co-managed, it's going to be one single central route co-managed, but the Iranians get oversight. They have the precedence, not the Omanis. And rather than waiting 60 days, as the memorandum of misunderstanding that was signed between Trump and the Ayatollah originally called for in June, where they were going to be given a 60-day toll-free access to kind of get all the oil and stuff moving out of the strait again. That will not happen. As soon as this deal is finalized, which could come possibly by Friday, as soon as this deal is finalized, the Iranians and Omanis will create a joint tolling system, and they will both be able to start making money off this, which is a complete strategic defeat for the United States.
But Trump said, and I assume this is where you're going here. Trump said that we would charge toll, that it would be us.
Yeah. Well, that was never on the books. That was a Trump verbal diarrhea moment again, and I'm frankly over it. The orange man has a lot of gas, and he releases it at most inopportune
times.
The puffer fish strategy.
That's literally what this is. Right. I never even thought about that. It's all like, we don't have the capability. I'm just going to say that we're going to kill them all.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
And you can do that one or two times and it might get you out of a sticky wicket. But if you do it every time and you never deliver, then everybody knows you're impotent. A bit flaccid. And that's America today. I mean, to be honest, it's the boomerocracy. We're run by flaccid men. And in Lindsey Graham's case, they have a lot of penis envy. But going forward with this analysis, the Iranians have defeated us strategically in this case, too, because Marco Rubio, the president, every administration official, the UN is now saying you cannot cede this issue of control to Iran, allow them to impose tolls, even if it is jointly with Oman, because it's going to set a precedence now for these other natural waterways that everybody uses.
Right.
And guess what? It doesn't matter. We lost the war that we started, so the victor gets the spoils. Thank God they're not crazy as we thought they were. They're not talking about cooking off nukes in Tel Aviv or New York. That's not going to happen. Clearly, the Iranian government wants to be treated like a normal government.
Right.
Clearly, they want to have a clean, normal, you know, representative role in their region. This is how they're going to get it.
Yeah, they've got the U.S. in a bind. It's like a genie, and they can extract one wish, but it's like a monkey's paw. So if they ask for too much, they're screwed, right? I think this is also a big factor. Like, if they get involved in, let's just say, like, they cut Oman out of it, well, that's a pretext for Israel and America to always try to go back there, always, and try to say, oh, they took it for themselves. We want to help our allies, our friends in the Gulf. We want to give Iran another reason to target these bases. I think the Iranians are very sober-minded when it comes to this. I watched that clip of Prajevskin.
They're incredibly sober-minded.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, I you know, was always hawkish about Iran. I never trusted the Islamic Republic. I still don't trust the Islam. I don't trust anybody.
Sure.
But to be fair, in this war, they have demonstrated they're not the crazies. They're not. Every time we've escalated, they've met us on the same level. Every time that, you know, that's, it's always been tit for tat. It's been very legalistic. That indicates a rational actor. And you can work with that. You can actually work with that.
Right. I think on our end, when we talk about a big giant glow will destroy your entire civilization, where we have military service members issuing complaints about their superior officers, telling them they're at war to light the signal fire for Jesus to return.
Right.
And then we're told we have to go to war with them to end a theocracy. It's all just a bit absurd. And I think when you look at our relationship with the wars in the Middle East, it's very clear Israel has this insane influence on us. Zionists really control our foreign policy. It's why I call it an occupied government, right? But when you look at Ukraine, when you look at Ukraine,
we're a colony.
Yeah, 100%. King George III over there right now, 250 years, and they did it to us again. It is what it is. But with Zelensky, this is a guy that was like Kevin Spacey. He played the president on TV. He was basically installed into power, in my view, my opinion. And then now he says, oh, no, we don't have election. We don't do that here. And, you know, he's been in power for X number of years. And
it's the great democracy.
Yes, the greatest. The IDF is the most moral army in the world, and Ukraine is the greatest democracy. And that's right. And I got a bridge to sell you as well. But when it comes to Zelensky and his activities, they're saying they're nearly totally out of air defense. What's going on there? And what's the reality of these fortress cities in Ukraine?
Yeah, and if you can go to the Weichert brief on Substack, that is the featured article today, was my breakdown, because I've been, unlike the Western media, I am closely monitoring what's going on the Eastern Ukrainian front. Basically, the Ukrainians knew this was coming. And when I say this, about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago now, no, it was about a month ago, the Russians quietly took Konstantinovka, which was one of those fortress, I think there's three or four of them. That was one of those fortress cities. And once they took the Konstantinovka, they were then able to steadily begin a classic Russian encirclement campaign of the remaining handful of fortress cities. And these are cities that the Ukrainians have spent years building up into basically fortresses, knowing full well that this was kind of the last line of defense. This is Donetsk. This is kind of the last line of defense before the Russians can completely take all of eastern Ukraine, the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine,
right,
by the way.
Right.
And so that was the last holdout. And they did a good job. Look, they've been able to hold out for three years, really. But, the Russians are just this. The attritional warfare is what Russia does. And they've ground the Ukrainians out. Meanwhile, the Ukrainians are throwing whatever weapons and men and women that they have at this problem set. And the Ukrainians figured pretty quickly that, yeah, go ahead.
No, I don't like it when you're not patriotic. It's patriotic to support press gangs. It's patriotic to support conscription. Like, here's the thing. For people,
and if we're not careful, it's going to happen here, too.
Seriously, they're doing AI simulations on the draft right now. But in Ukraine, they don't even worry about the draft. They show up to your house. I saw one guy, playing video games, and I beat the guy. I made him mad. He said, I'm going to find you. And then the van showed up and took him to the front line. And countless videos of this. This is just a reality. To people in the West, they need to understand, it's a world war already. We're talking about Ukraine. Yeah. We're talking about the Middle East. Just talk about how wide this conflict zone is, the Caspian Sea and all of that as well.
Yeah, well, the good news here is if we do, however temporarily, and I think it'll go 60 days or maybe 180 days, if we do get a reprieve in Iran, the prospects of this really going global are frozen for a period of time. Because what you had up until a week ago was, the Ukrainians, and there's a reason they did this firing on those Iranian ships, or the Iranian ship in the Caspian Sea. And it's because the gains the Russians are making on the Eastern Front. So basically, once Konstantinovka fell to the Russians, the Ukrainians, Kyiv, they all realize, uh-oh, it's only a matter of like weeks, maybe a couple months before we lose those fortress cities. So what do they start doing? Well, they start doing these you know, impressment things where they're gathering men and women off the street. But also they started doing the drone attacks into Russia proper, targeting civilian soft targets, gasoline stations with lots of people waiting. They started targeting the refineries. They started targeting the wheat production, the wheat transportation, not only in the Black Sea, but out of the Sea of Azov, which is, you know, huge. Yeah, that's the wheat coming out of southern Russia is a major contributor to food stuff for the global south.
And so they're contributing. We wouldn't tolerate having this done to us ever. Like this is the point that I want to draw from this.
And this would have been nuclear war by now if this were done to us, and even a fraction was done to us.
Right.
So, but yeah.
No, I mean just but, people but in what, the West. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, people in the West, they have this attitude of like, we can just get away with it. We can just keep doing it. We can keep bombing them. We keep paying for the bombs. Trump says, oh, it's beautiful. We're not bombing them. I sell the Europeans the bombs and the missiles and the equipment, and then they get to do it.
Right.
Right. You don't get to just pass
the Russians are returning the favor, by the way, in Iran, right? Most of those bases that have been destroyed of ours have been thanks to Russian targeting. Most of the ships, technically no ship has been damaged. Wink. But, you know, the U.S. Navy, I think, has suffered some damage or near damage.
Laundry fire.
Of that is... Right. Most of that is because of the Russian satellite telemetry they're providing the Iranian missile guys. So anyway, let me just go back to the Ukraine thing, because the reason Ukraine is doing these drone strikes, the reason Ukraine desperately tried to destroy and get the Iranians to attack them, which was the goal. They wanted Iran to attack. And we know the Iranians were prepared to do 3 missile attacks in the last week on Ukraine proper, and they were talked out of it by the Russians. The reason that the Ukrainians were doing this is because they knew if left alone, the Russians were going to take Eastern Ukraine. And once they take those remaining fortress cities, the Russians have a straight shot, flat land. It'll be a run into the Dnipro River system. The Ukrainians are desperately trying to reform a new defensive line there. That's not as easy to defend there as it was in those original fortress cities. The Russians are talking about conscripting 250 to 500,000 troops after the September legislative elections. I think that's what will happen. And then they'll be able to send those additional troops into the Dnipro defenses. They'll take them. And then they have the pick of the litter. Either they can go for Odessa, which I have been told by my Russian sources is the end point. That's where they want to end the war, is holding Odessa. Or they could conceivably take Kyiv and collapse the whole thing.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. Because if they take Odessa, that's their only deep water port, right?
That's Ukraine's only deep water port. Yes.
So it's game over for them as like a functional world power.
If the Russians would be smart to end it there, because what they basically do is leave NATO and the United States with a rump Ukraine that's basically a welfare queen. And, you know, but it has nothing to offer. All the rare earth, all the blessed rare earths that we kept hearing about. Guess what? When the deal was made, they were already under Russian feet. Now they'll really be under Russian feet. So Ukraine, Western Ukraine, a rump state, Galicia, it basically becomes useless. It's a non-entity. It's a welfare queen for the United States and European taxpayers.
It's the perfect end equation for, you know, the Western transnational capital Zionist globalist agenda, because you get to destroy this country, you get to take it out, and then you can rebuild it. In whatever image you want to do. And Larry Fink, he went over there with Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, and he met with Zelensky. And, you know, I'm sure this is all a contingency. So
it is, but I think this is contingent on the idea that they were going to hold on to Odessa at least.
Mm.
I don't know what a post war Ukraine looks like if the Russians get what I think the Russians are aiming for, which is Odessa. It's going to be a very different country because that Ukraine has nothing to offer. What does it have to offer?
How does that change the world order when and if that happens, Brandon?
So you have two things happening at once. And again, this is why they are connected and why we are, if not in a world war, we're almost there. You have the collapse of American military power in Iran in about 6 months. That happened in about 6 months. We've never seen anything like this. And this was a strategic defeat on a grand strategic level. So U.S. military power is over in that part of the world. The collapse of Ukraine, which is inevitable, I think, at this point, is basically the end of NATO. NATO goes on probably in name only. It's basically like the EU. It's there, but okay, what does that mean? And that's basically the end of the U.S.-led post-Cold War world. The real money, the real military power is now in Eurasia. We've been depleted. We've been drained. We've been humiliated. We've been defeated. What do we do from here? My concern at that point, and there are reports this morning that the Pentagon is now going to rewrite their nuclear warfare doctrine to make the deployment of tactical non-strategic nuclear weapons in warfare easier to do.
Hold on.
Let's
not gloss over that here. What are you just breaking right here for people that don't know about this?
So the Pentagon is going to make it easier to use nuclear weapons in a future war, basically. Non-strategic nukes, tactical nukes, small yield nukes. Because the conventional capacity has been drained so badly. I just talked to Mark Kansian of CSIS the last hour on Mario's show, and he said that for the next 4 to 5 years, America is in what's known as the window of vulnerability. We've blown through our critical stockpiles. Our enemies aren't relenting. So basically, for about 4 or 5 years, we're sitting naked. Well, he didn't say this, but me reading between the lines, because Mark would never say something like this. This is me saying this. I then, in my head, paired what he just told me with this morning's report that the Pentagon is rewriting their nuclear warfare doctrine to basically make it liberal, more liberal in the use of nuclear, or easier to use nuclear weapons in a non-nuclear war. So what that tells me is to close the window of vulnerability over the next 5 years, the DOD or Department of War is basically going to say it's okay to use nukes.
That's the thing. You know, we withdraw from all these arms treaties. We don't care about them. I think it was George Bush Jr. that withdrew from, I'm blanking. I just heard Lawrence Wilkerson talk about this.
It was the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Now, to be fair on that one, and I'm by no means a Bush supporter, but to be fair on that one, there was an argument at the time that we were trying to do space-based missile defense, and that treaty was complicating it. But looking back on it, we shouldn't have done it because we didn't end up getting space-based missile defense, did we?
No, we didn't. If we look at like something like New START, though, specifically, the Russians beg us to re-sign it. We're just like, no, we're not going to do that anymore. It's making an angrier world.
It's making an angrier world, and even the New START treaty in 2010, right? What did that treaty that Obama negotiated do? It actually allowed the Russians wanted the ability, because the Russians knew where this was going. The Russians wanted the ability to build out a massive number of new and advanced non-strategic tactical nuclear weapons. We allowed them to do that. We did not reciprocate because Obama was saying, we don't want to do that. So what we have today is what we've always had. There's some new systems coming online. I'm not advocating for nuclear war, but I am saying New START even was a bad deal for America because we told the Russians, yeah, you go ahead and build your non-strategic nukes. And now we're in a position where there's an imbalance favoring Russia, which is another reason we shouldn't be picking these fights.
Yes, and this, just to take it back to everything, this is why we can't be in these wars and situations, because the degradation of American power didn't just start under Trump or under Biden or under Obama. This has been going on for a very long time. And this is why the richest nation in the world, the most powerful nation in the world, we had hegemony. We don't have it anymore.
We don't anymore.
Think about losing that. Yeah. How crazy is that? Break that down.
Well, look, you know, and I keep bringing this up to people. I used to work at the National Interest. It's a great publication, wonderful people. It was Nixon's think tank that him and Kissinger created in the early 80s. And the Center for the National Interest, the publications of the National Interest. But anyway, in the pages of the National Interest in 1994, you had Gene Kirkpatrick, the former UN ambassador under Reagan, who was very much a neocon, She wrote the essay Dictatorships and Democracies. But she sided with Pat Buchanan in 1994. She wrote A Normal Country in a Normal Time. And in that 3.5-page, 4-page essay, she outlined in 1994 how we needed to basically bring the legions home. That we had no business anymore. The Cold War was over. We defeated communism. The threat was gone. That was a unique moment, she said, in our history. And now we needed to go back to what George Washington wanted. She was writing this in support of her colleague, Pat Buchanan, who was receiving at the time a lot of flack because he was saying these things. Now we're in a position again where we've completely broken the back of U.S. military hegemony, U.S. military power. We have to reassess the depleted arsenal, the depleted SPR, the depletion we're going through. All of this is a golden opportunity, Rex. We now can go back to what my new book coming out in November through Tucker Carlson Books is about. It's called Fortress Americas. We go back to Western Hemispheric defense. We go back to the ideas of the founding fathers, the new Monroe Doctrine. We don't get involved anymore in these, wars, on the periphery. We stop poking the Russians. The Russians get their part of the world. The Chinese get their part of the world. We get our part of the world. And we run this thing together.
And that's the great irony of this war against multipolarity from the West. It's really created multipolarity. I mean, you look at BRICS, look at SIPs, right? Biden weaponized SWIFT against the Russians and also froze a bunch of their assets. So they created an alternative system. Right. Same thing with Baidu, like the Chinese, like that's GPS. Right. So we've done gain of function research on a whole bunch of things we shouldn't have. I think that's kind of the takeaway of the past, decade or two. And I think more people are waking up to that, Brandon. I think you do excellent work. Plug your book, website, plug your articles. Where can people find you?
Yeah, well, the newest book, like I said, it's coming out November 3rd or 10th, I think. And Skyhorse is Tucker Carlson is an imprint. It's Tucker Carlson Books. And it's called Fortress America's A New Monroe Doctrine. And it makes clear this is not an ode to imperialism. This is about trade and reinforcing our defensive perimeter. Then the other place you can find me is the Weikert Brief on Substack. And I am the co-host of the Mario Knopfel podcast.
Yes, and you're going to be on there today and tomorrow and later.
Yeah, in about 10 more minutes. Less than that. Yeah.
But it's right there. We the Brandon. Follow him there. Also, check out his work at 1945.com. Brandon, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Talk to you later.
Appreciate it. Wow. What a terrific guest. What a terrific hour. We just broke down and covered the waterfront, as my dad would say, of everything you wanted to know about Iran, Ukraine, our thoughts about the domestic political reality in the United States. This is why I love doing this show, is because I get to have these conversations with people and we all get to have it together where, the viewer, listener at home, I know you want to know these things just as bad as I do. So I want to give that to you. That's my 360 win for today. I'll see you for the War Room.
Fellow patriots, the first thing the globalists and the leftists do when they want to silence you is go after your merchant accounts, go after your business payment systems. It's that simple. They try to cut off your ability to even receive money or make payments. If you are a conservative business owner, Google is watching you, Meta, Facebook is watching you, Amazon, all of the major big tech is watching you. If you think for one second that they are not orchestrating and coordinating their efforts behind the scenes to take you offline and out of business and render you harmless to the system and the machine, you are wrong. The question is not if, it's when Stripe, Shopify, PayPal, Square, they're all part of the same big tech machine. Because once there's only one central system, they can bring in the universal credit score. The head of BlackRock, Larry Fink, has been very clear. Once they have the system in place and they're close, they are going to shut down everybody that isn't part of their system, even people that aren't political. This is about total control. They've just got to get to the patriots that are opposing them to get to you. And FirstUnitedPayments.com stands directly in the tyrant's way. My fellow Americans, this is your call to action. Call or email First United Payments now and ask them how you can protect your business against the globalist predatory attacks and shutdowns today. And talk to a real human here in the good old U.S. of A. by calling toll-free 877-899-1313. You've got to be able to have your own business. You've got to be able to operate without these globalist sharks, this mafia shutting you down. And First United Payments is the tip of the spear. Proven warriors, ladies and gentlemen, in this fight. Online merchants, this is the place for you. Now visit FirstUnitedPayments.com right now.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.